I'm sure if you tried to sell your books in Phoenician wooden dollars, that not that many people would buy them either, right?
Good morning, ladies. Welcome to Bad Voltage, Season 1, Episode
5.
Episode 5. My name is Brian. With me, as always, as every episode, because I am never not here, is Jeremy.
Hello, all.
Stuart.
Who the hell are you?
And Jono.
Hear me now.
Very, very nice. Jeremy, hey, what cool topics we got going on for the peeps this morning here?
Well, in this segment, this is proof that we really do listen to your feedback, listeners, and we are going to talk about what I believe is the most requested segment, and that is cryptocurrency with a focus on Bitcoin. What do we have next, Jono?
We're also going to do an interview with Jeff Atwood, who is the guy who's behind Discourse, which is a replacement for aging forum software. It's fantastic. Jeremy's a big fan. And we're going to talk to Jeff about the product, about the project, where it's going, and what you can expect in the future.
Yep. Jono is himself a big fan of streaming television, all that sort of thing. And he went out and bought Roku 2, I think. And he'll be talking about it.
And then we'll be talking about open source phones, you know, all the good stuff, the Jolas, the Ubuntu Touches, the Firefox OS, and what we think of it and what we think their chance of success is.
Yes, and we're of course going to get to your letters. We had some great emails. A little angry this time round.
Yeah, a little bit.
An ordinary letter segment.
Some people need some more fiber in their diet or something. But anyway, we're going to get to the letters, and we're also going to be focusing from the next show more on posts sent to community.badvoltage.org. So this is going to be the last time we're going to focus just on the letters. But yeah, we're going to get your feedback out on the airwaves.
And now, Bad Voltage. For this segment, we are going to cover a topic that has been, I would say, one of our most requested topics from a viewer or a listener perspective, and that is cryptocurrencies, specifically Bitcoin, possibly a little bit of Litecoin, and the rest of them, I don't think anyone cares about realistically.
Yes.
So for those of you who aren't exactly familiar with what a cryptocurrency is, Jono, why don't you give them a brief explanation of kind of how it works?
Right. Now, the caveat here is that I learned about this in the last couple of days. So I'm sure that I've got this wrong and you're all going to email me about it. And those emails are heartily received, okay, and ignored. So basically, the way Bitcoin works is it's a virtual currency. And the way this works is that anyone in the world can mine Bitcoins. So the way this works is that people can contribute their computing power, and your computer will go through a series of very complicated mathematical problems. And when those problems are solved, it generates a set of Bitcoins. I think it's 25 at a time. And those computing problems get more and more complicated. So there's always a constrained set of coins that are available. Now, ultimately, there will be a limit of 21 million coins. Right now, there's about 12 million of those coins. Okay. And basically, the way it works is that through peer-to-peer networks, everybody has can have essentially a log of all of the transactions that are made in the world. And transactions are made on a person-to-person basis using the same kind of encryption that's basically used for logging into Linux systems and things like that. So essentially, what this means is that Bitcoin has become a currency that is effectively decentralized, that anybody can mine these coins to a limit. And there's a whole set of economic kind of implications for whether they're valuable, whether they're not valuable, and things like that. That's basically, from what I can tell, how it works. Now, the question we have, and the question our listeners have posed to us, is do we think it's actually going to work? I mean, is it magical unicorn currency, or is it actually going to catch on?
And there's been some examples. Definition of work would be my first question. I mean, there's quite a few definitions of work.
Right.
I mean, technically, right now, it functions. You can exchange bitcoins around, and you can buy things like, oh, I don't know, illicit drugs and child pornography with it. But beyond that, I don't know. I've tried to sell, like, some of my books and whatnot using bitcoins, and nobody gives a crap. Like, right. Two guys in a basement outside of London will use it, but that's it so far, at least as far as I can tell.
There are some reasons.
That, though, merely is a question of popularity, right? I mean, I'm sure if you tried to sell your books in Phoenician wooden dollars, that not that many people would buy them either, right?
Here's the thing. If two guys bought my books in Phoenician wooden dollars, how badass would that be? See, that would make me freak out, because then I'd have Phoenician wooden dollars.
I'm pretty sure if you tried to sell your books in dollars, nobody would buy your books.
But yeah, I mean, essentially, there's a question of popularity. When we say, does it work? Right now, you can go and buy real things with Bitcoin today if you want to. Yeah. And actual physical goods and stuff. It's not all buying pornography or physical drugs off of the Silk Road or things. You can go and buy electronic equipment, so on and so forth, from a limited number of sellers. Yeah. In exactly the same way as the four of us could invent our own little private currency and use it. And that would be fine. I think when people say, is it going to work? What they're asking is there going to be a point where I'll be able to go to a reasonable proportion of shops and buy things? Maybe not every shop, in the same way that not every shop takes American Express. But will it take off in the mainstream?
Now, just to follow up on the introduction a little bit, an important point that I left out is one of the reasons why Bitcoin has become very interesting to people is because the transaction fees are basically nominal. Like if you transfer money from one person to another today, the bank charges you a load of money. It charges you 3% or 5% or whatever it might be for doing that. Now with Bitcoin, it's negligible, right? And what's interesting is that you can actually see all transactions on this.
All the way back to the Genesis block.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Is available to everybody. And you can see the cost of the transaction. Now, in my mind, whether it's going to work or not, the banks are going to, I suspect, stand
so
in the way.
Transaction fees, though, is not the most interesting part, because once you hit the limit of bitcoins, the only way the system will generate money is transaction fees. So transaction fees are low now, but that's an artifact of the system being new. Transaction fees have to rise eventually. Yep. So I think the most interesting aspect is really the fact that there's no central authority to it.
I think one of the really important things about Bitcoin is the distinction in the model of the world between people who like the idea of Bitcoin and everyone else who doesn't. The fact that there's no central authority is a good thing from the point of view of people on Reddit, right? But if you look at governments and banks and so on, they absolutely do not like the idea there's no central authority, because it makes it incredibly easy to do things like launder money and buy drugs with it, right? Now, from the point of view of Bitcoin fans, that's a feature. It's not a bug.
See,
right?
Money should not
be trackable.
I disagree with that. I would say vehemently in that Bitcoin is absolutely more traceable in every way than physical paper cash. Cash and US dollars will always be easier to do illicit things with. So that argument that it's mostly used to do illicit things, maybe right now,
absolutely not. You buy something with cash from me. Go ahead. How would you do it? Cash is fine as long as you're standing in the same building as the person you're buying stuff from. What Bitcoin does is it creates a genuinely global economy, right?
That's traceable forever, though.
It's traceable
because the blockchain is permanent.
It's traceable.
Buying drugs with something where the public blockchain is publicly accessible to anyone forever seems like a spectacularly bad idea to me.
I agree totally with
Jeremy on this one. Yeah, and realistically, if you go down to say a local grocery store with a pile of 20s, you can buy a prepaid Visa or MasterCard that has no personal information attached to it, then go hop online and utilize it. If you do it properly and don't do it on your own private network and things like that, you're going to be much more secure and untraceable if that's really important to you than if you used Bitcoin.
But the thing is, in terms of whether it's going to work or not, in my mind, there's two things that are going to potentially stand in the way of it not working. Like, I think we'd all agree that Bitcoin, it's an innovative way in which people can can trade goods, right? Now, to a degree, those goods have been largely illegal in certain cases because it's been something that's been unknown to the masses. It's flown under the radar, right?
Yeah.
I think there's two things that are going to potentially stand in the way. One is banks, right? I think banks, this fundamentally gets in the way of their business model. JP Morgan Chase, I think it is, has already tried to patent the concept of virtual currencies. Now, it wouldn't surprise me if the banks are going to be lobbying various governments to try and regulate away from Bitcoin. Now, the Bitcoin, it decentralizes things, but the internet's decentralized. It doesn't mean that we don't have governments trying to stop people using the internet in certain ways. That's the reason why the Silk Road shut down. The government got involved and they shut it down. And as we talked about in a previous, I think, previous show. Now, the other thing I think is right now, the currency is massively fluctuating. At one point, one Bitcoin was worth, I think, $1,000. And then the following day or a couple of days later, it went right down. What I don't know, because I don't have the economics background, is whether that's going to settle.
Well, that's...
Like, Jeremy, you made a...
Well, eventually it should reach a closer equilibrium than it does now. I mean, it's gone from, what, $300 to $1,200 has been the range in the last 60 days.
That's one of the really interesting points about it. That yes, you can buy stuff with Bitcoin, but in practice, merchants aren't actually pricing their stuff in Bitcoins. Well, they're letting you pay with Bitcoins, but they're basically pricing their
US dollars or pounds.
And then providing a Bitcoin equivalent, right?
Correct.
So no one's saying this thing costs one Bitcoin. What they're saying is this thing costs $1 or you can pay for it with today's amount. I mean, I had a look, right? Bitcoinshop.us, which is one of the big shops for buying stuff with Bitcoin. You buy a bag of sweets, it was 0.036 Bitcoins today. 12 days ago, it was 0.021, two-thirds of that price, right? If you walk into your Brian's local grocery store and say, I want a bag of flour, and the guy goes, it's gone up $2 since yesterday, and tomorrow it might be $4 cheaper, that's not a global economy, that's the frigging Weimar Republic. No one wants to do that.
But that, right. I mean, real, that's
that has happened
down
to real countries' currencies, though. I mean, just look at Zimbabwe, but you're comparing a very new currency, and I don't even know that I would call it a currency, based on a completely new paradigm with something that's been around for thousands of years. So it's obviously going to be more volatile now. I don't think it being more volatile now is a question.
Well, the other thing that relates to this as well is that there's going to be a limited number of Bitcoins, right? And right now, we only have half of those Bitcoins available.
Doesn't matter.
What I'm curious, about
the,
is
the thing tops out in 2140.
Right, but the point, I think the point that Jeremy's making, the point that I would agree with is... Right now, this is a new thing that's got a lot of uncertainty attached to it. The core principle of the system seems to work, but the fluctuation is no doubt down to the fact that this is brand new. It's not really been done before.
With Eagle, but that got shut down too. And I think you mentioned banks and other things as the biggest kind of detriment or stepping stone for this to be successful. If not, I would say it's governments, because the people who have the most to lose if something like Bitcoin... Let's just go with cryptocurrencies in general. Who knows if it would actually be Bitcoin? Would be governments who all have fiat currencies in the end, right? But they do it because they can
tax. Federal Reserve's not.
If there
thrilled.
Was a fiat currency that was popular, accepted everywhere, but not backed by any kind of economic or monetary policy, governments would be the ones that be have the most to lose. So if it gets shut down, I would say it would get shut down by a government, not by a.
Well, the U.S. government's already doing this, right?
No,
they were actually more tacitly accepting of it than I thought. It's really the Chinese government, which is why you saw the volatility in the last day, is what happened.
But what I mean is the U.S. government, what I mean is the U.S. government's acknowledged that this is a thing. It's not going away. They put together a task force, I believe, to try and identify ways in which income is potentially going to be taxed.
But that's exactly the point here. The governments in general aren't necessarily, this is a terrible idea. It's, this is fine as long as we get to regulate it like we get to regulate everything else. Now, the kind of underlying Bitcoin mentality is, no government regulation for us, man. We don't need any of that. The government's like, nah, that's not how it works, dude. Right? You get... I mean, one of the... Jeremy mentioned fiat currency there. The important point about... a currency declared by a government is that you can use it to pay taxes to that government. By definition, I mean, yes, Bitcoin only works as long as people decide to accept it. US dollars are at least in theory the same. But, you know, everyone could just say, we're not going to accept US dollars anymore, the hell with it. And then it stops being a useful currency, apart from the fact that you can pay taxes to the US government with it, because by definition, they have to accept it. It's their currency. Bitcoin doesn't have that. It doesn't have a kind of final reservoir of what you can do with it. If everyone in the world says, screw it, we don't care about Bitcoin, if you've got all 21 million Bitcoins, it doesn't matter. That's not the case with dollars.
Now, this is a big topic. We've only been able to delve into a tiny amount of it, right?
What I'm kind of hearing, though, is that we all think Bitcoins are kind of dumb, but for totally different reasons.
I think it's an interesting experiment, if nothing else.
So let's wrap this up and see what each of us think, right? So Brian, you kick off. Like, what do you think? Do you think it's going to succeed? That's the main question we set out with. Like, do you think it's going to succeed?
If by succeed you mean people can use it actually like as a currency, then no, I don't. I mean, it currently can't succeed because the prices fluctuate too dramatically for merchants to be able to rely on it for an income. Therefore, it's dead.
Jeremy, what do you think?
I would say, if by that definition of succeed, I don't know that it will succeed. I mean, if you look at, John Quiglin recently wrote something where it's going to go to zero probably very soon. I also don't agree with that. I think it's going to be an interesting social experiment that in the long term will retain some amount of value. I think it definitely could go either way, depending on what major governments, you know, the US, China, the G8 in general, I guess, decide how they decide to regulate it. But I don't think I'm nearly as negative on it as the three of you guys.
Ack.
I wouldn't say I'm necessarily negative. I think it will succeed in the same way that mini discs did, or something like that, right? There'll be a small group of people who think it's a good idea, we'll use it, it'll be perfectly viable if you get involved in the same way that Linux has, to be honest with you. If you're involved in that community, it's a perfectly viable thing to do, but it hasn't really got decent traction to the consumer mainstream. And that's what I think Bitcoin will do.
And I think that what we're seeing right now with Bitcoin is the MySpace of virtual currencies. I think it's right at the beginning, it's innovative, it's different. People are getting involved in it because they think it's cool. But ultimately, what we're going to see in 5 years is going to be completely different to what we've got now. Because I think what's going to happen is Bitcoin is going to be regulated heavily by governments. So they're going to try to. Banks are going to get in the way and try and provide legal protections to stop it from progressing. And this will result in something else that will ultimately satisfy.
You think
I think
Facebook
laws tend to
cover.
Be overgeneralized, though. There won't be a Bitcoin law. There'll be a cryptocurrency law.
No. It will, yeah, but yeah. I suspect that the next thing will figure a way around.
There'll be a
so you think
things
it's a
act like money
fiat currency
regulated.
Escalating no. arms race, basically.
Right, exactly. So, you know what? That's what we think. We try to get into it as best we can in a short period of time. This is a massive topic. We want to know what you folks think. We're really keen to kind of drill down to what the heart of what Bitcoin is and whether it's going to work or not. Go to community.badvoltage.org. and share your thoughts and let us know what you think. Remember the days when TV was simple? As a wee lad living in England, there were, count them, 4 channels. And as a freshly pubescent young boy, of course I was constantly angling for boobs, of which there were even fewer of. Although choice was limited, TV was simple. It was something that even my mum and dad could use. These days, TV is hard. We've got hundreds of channels, DVR boxes, on-demand services, streaming, podcasts, and more. TV is no longer the box in the corner of the room. It's an amalgamation of services all sent to the same screen. Now, many a device exists to bring all of this together. The Chromecast, as was reviewed by Brian in Season 1, Episode 2 of Bad Voltage, is one such example, as well as Google TV, Apple TV, Xbox One, and a wealth of others. But there's another contender, and one that's been generating quite a lot of buzz recently, Roku. The Roku is about as simple as it gets. It's a box that plugs into your TV, connects to your wireless network, and provides a bunch of channels in which content is streamed. Such channels include Netflix, Amazon Instant Video, Redbox, Blockbuster, Hulu, Disney, Fox, ESPN, Pandora, and more. In fact, Roku boasts of 31,000 movies across over 1,000 channels. Now, there are many different Rokus available, from the basic Roku LT at $50 that simply streams content, to the Roku One at $60 that adds 1080p HD video, the Roku Two at $80 that adds a headphone jack and a remote control, and the Roku Three at $100 that adds motion control features for games. Fortunately, all Rokus are currently having a holiday discount right now, so you want to get over to Roku.com and check it out. Now, recently I got a Roku 2, but how does it measure up? Well, hardware-wise, the unit's really compact and simple. There's connectors for HDMI and component inputs, a power input, and that's basically about it. The included remote control is a bare-bones affair, with transport controls and some branded buttons to get you to Netflix, Amazon Instant Video, and others quickly. And a neat feature in the Roku 2 is a headphone jack in the remote. Now, this is used, for example, if you're laid in bed with your partner watching TV and he or she wants to go to sleep and wants the sound off. You just plug your headphones into the remote control and the audio on the TV is muted. It's a really nice touch and surprisingly useful. Setup was equally simple. I plugged the device into my TV, powered it up, selected my wireless network, and I started selecting which channels I wanted. Now, of course, after every channel that I set up, I then often need to go and add credentials, such as my Netflix account, and that's a little fiddly with a remote control, but you know what? You only have to do this once, so it's not that big of a deal. One of the neatest features of the Roku is the global search. From the home screen, I can do a search for a movie, and it shows me all of the matches across paid and subscription services, complete with prices. Now, as somebody who uses both Netflix and Amazon Instant Video, this makes it really simple for me to see all content that's available to me, and to also find the cheapest place to rent a movie that we want to watch. One downside, though, is that for some reason YouTube just isn't there. I'm assuming Google not especially happy with the Roku. So the features look good, but how well does it actually work in operation? Well, very, very well. In fact, I bought two of them. I loved it so much. From a streaming perspective, the audio and video streams perfectly. It's fully in sync and in HD on the Roku 2 and above. The wireless performance of the Roku 2 was very, very sturdy, and given that my lounge is right at the edge of our wireless network, I was really impressed with the performance here. My PlayStations and other devices have not fared so well in such testing conditions. From a general is-it-easy-to-use perspective, Roku have done a wonderful job. The user interface is simple and it's slick, and it's devilishly simple to search for content, and accessing channels is easy. My only criticism here is that the Roku channels are a little simple. As an example, the Netflix client on the iPad is a bit nicer and more featureful, which I presume is some kind of limitation in Roku's platform. This would be a nice thing for them to fix in the future. So, what is the bad voltage verdict? The Roku 2 is simple, stylish, and gets you to the good stuff with as little fuss as possible.
Okay, so just to paraphrase here, the Roku is an awesome little device at streaming a whole butt ton of stuff over the inner tubes. And that's really cool.
Yes.
I like that a lot. I mean, that's 90% of what I do. But the other 10% of my TV watching ends up being playing back ripped video files that I pulled off of DVD because I don't want my kids scratching up all my DVDs and Blu-rays or home movies. What? Honestly, you gotta do that. Seriously, dude, as little John O'Jack gets older, you gotta start ripping those DVDs. He will scratch the holy bejesus out of them, and so fast. But so that seems to be the big hole with the Roku device, is that it can't play back local content.
Yeah, it's definitely a limitation. I mean, it's not a limitation for me because I don't really have any local content that I want to play. And if I do, I'll plug my laptop into the TV in the rare occasions that I do.
That's so 1990s nerd to go and plug your laptop into your TV.
But that's because I just don't have local content. For me, everything I need is on the internet and I just need it streamed to the TV.
I don't have a Roku to verify this, but I think there is a third party app that will actually stream local content to the Roku.
It wouldn't surprise me. There are loads and loads of apps, not just the channels. There's loads of apps in the Roku store as well that do all kinds of different things. There's games and all kinds of stuff. So it wouldn't surprise me if there's something, something there. And Jeremy, you mentioned about the YouTube thing, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, on the note of the bunch of channels that there are, about a day or maybe 2 days ago, Roku did announce that there will be a YouTube channel for the Roku 3 starting today. And it's going to come out for, you said you have the Roku 2, correct? So that's going to be early 2014, they said. And I think they're going to roll it out across almost all the devices. So a little update for you.
That was the massive, massive gaping hole for me, was the fact that...
Watch a lot of YouTube.
I listened to Brian's Chromecast review, and I thought that sounds brilliant. Something about the Roku I like, though. There's something weird about, like, I just like what they're doing as a company. And what surprised me is when I bought mine, loads of other people came out the woodwork and said, you know what, I love my Roku. I bought three or four of them for the different rooms in my house. So I was delighted when you mentioned that. So that was the missing link for me.
One of the things that I think is strange, though, I mean, Roku appear to have basically sewn up the market for people like you, Jono, who don't have any local stuff, who watch everything streaming, subscribe to a bunch of different streaming services. If you want that and you want to do them all, then you go and buy a Roku box. They're basically the only game in town. But if you look at the Roku 3, it's now got motion controls for games. It's like, we're not satisfied being a streaming box. Now what we're going to be is a PS 1/2, right? Stop doing that.
Must have all the Angry Birds.
Yeah, but I mean, you could say that about any company. Every company starts out doing one thing. Like Microsoft made BASIC, right? And then they wanted to dominate the operating system market, right? I mean, you could level the same criticism towards any company. What's interesting to me is what Roku have managed to achieve, like, compared to the rest. I don't know anyone with Google TV.
Especially amongst non-technical users. I think the Roku definitely has the non-technical user market, the vast majority of it.
Yeah, I think that's what's really interesting. When you said, you know lots of people who've got it, you say, I've got a Roku, and loads of other people pop up and say, I've got it too. Once you hit a certain point, that things do snowball. It crossed the chasm, to quote the phrase, you know. So at that point, you get a bunch of developers who say, I want to bring my apps to this thing, where it didn't happen with the competitors. So once someone gets a little bit ahead of the competition, they then end up a long way ahead of the competition. And Roku have clearly done that. I mean, the thing my parents have got here in the UK is basically a rebranded Roku.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's happening as well is because these things are actually pretty cheap, right? It feels like you get a really good deal, and particularly for the build quality, as I mentioned in the review. I think what's happening is what's happened to us. Like, we bought one on Black Friday and we loved it, just loved everything about it. So we bought one for the bedroom as well. So we can, cause we have, a TV in the bedroom, and then we're like, well, you know, this would make a great gift for members of the family, whatever. And I think, so what happens is you start thinking Roku is solving problems because it's so good at what it does for not that much money. So, you know, it's not like I'm not going to go out and buy, like, spend X amount of money on Google TV for somebody or Apple TV, but Roku, much more likely to do that. So I think it's pretty rocking. I think they're doing a good job. And like I say, something about them as a company, I just like what they're doing. So, and I had no connection to them at all beforehand. I'd never used any Roku device, but I was blown away with
Roku. I think it's fairly impressive. I know old people that are afraid of computers that are streaming Netflix with a Roku now. And that to me is just mind boggling.
That's impressive.
Yeah, excellent. Right. Yeah, Roku me Amadeus. We like it. Yeah. Yes.
One final thing before we finish. You know what we need? Yes. We need a bad voltage channel on Roku.
Yes.
Okay, set it up.
If anybody wants to help out with a bad voltage channel on Roku, I have no idea how you do this, right? It's probably written in Haskell or some shit, right? Go to community.badvoltage.org and post the thread and let us know if you can make the magic happen for us. Now, as anyone who's listened to Bad Voltage in the past will know, we're always asking you folks to send us in suggestions for ideas and discussion topics for the show. One thing that we've had a ton of feedback from people on is the topic of this new plethora of open source mobile operating systems, of which Ubuntu, Firefox OS, and Yola are good examples of. Now, before we go on, I just want to provide a caveat in the interest of honesty. I work for Canonical, which is the company that invests in Ubuntu. So I work on the Ubuntu phone, right? I don't think I'm fundamentally biased towards anything Canonical does, but I have a lot more information about Ubuntu and I have less information about the other two. So I'm by definition going to be more biased. The rest of the guys, not so much. Ack used to work at Canonical, doesn't work there anymore. So I think we have a fairly independent panel of people to talk about this. So what I'd like to suggest we talk about is, like, first of all, what are these platforms doing? And secondly, do we think that any of them is going to be successful in this David and Goliath race that is there to unseat Google and Apple, or whether that's even the target market? Because with Firefox, for example, they're not really going after that market. So what do you guys think?
I think what you say there is the absolutely key point, really. I mean, what's success in this context? I owned a Nokia N9. I went and bought it. It worked fine. It did the stuff that I wanted it to do. I was able to purchase it. Is that success? If it is, I'm sure everyone will make that. Is it? Are either going to unseat Android and iOS? Different question entirely.
I hate to do this, but I would agree with Ek on that one. I mean, to me, it seems like Android and iOS, at least in the next couple of years, have a pretty strong foothold. And I don't personally think there's room for more than three, maybe, operating systems in the mobile space, in the mainstream mobile space. And with BlackBerry and the amount of money that Microsoft is willing to lose on Windows OS, and it still has basically no traction. I don't think I've ever seen a person have one for Firefox right. OS or Ubuntu or Sailfish to get in there is going to be exceedingly difficult, in my opinion. Yeah, but it's impossible.
Yeah, I kind of take the opposite opinion on this. I mean, obviously, unseating Android and iOS, that's a huge uphill battle that can't be done overnight. But in my opinion, Firefox OS, the way they're going about it, targeting kind of the lower end of the market, of the smartphone market, I think it really presents a real valuable opportunity that Android and iOS just aren't hitting. And honestly, you know, Ubuntu can't really hit either because it's a much more high-end device platform. So I think there's a very strong possibility of a three-way race between the three of those platforms with Firefox dominating the cheap handset.
Wasn't the whole point of KitKat to go after the low-end space? I mean, that was the whole focus of the last Android release, was phones with less than 512 megs of RAM, which is an astonishingly low market phone.
It hasn't even remotely succeeded, I don't think.
Well, it came out a month ago.
That kind of remains to be seen, though. Yeah.
I mean, my go-to example for low-end smartphones are my parents, both of whom have Android smartphones, right? And they're fine.
Running what, gingerbread or something?
Well, my dad's one is something incredibly ancient. This is ancient Sony thing, which has been like totally abandoned by the
upstream. Because those were a remarkably bad experience and therefore a pretty poor bar to set moving forward,
yeah.
I think.
But it honestly concerns me, the idea that KitKat, the new Android release, is going to do better on that sort of class of phone. When people say, oh, there were low-end smartphones, what they seem to mean is a Nexus 4, because that's old now. And you're like, what? Seriously, man? I've got stuff in my fridge older than that. That's not old.
The thing is,
you've got stuff in your fridge older than that?
Oh, God. You don't know what's in his fridge. I think the thing is looking at each of these, in my mind, the thing that's going to define... There's a couple of things that are going to define one of these. I think I agree with Jeremy that I think one of them, if any, are going to be successful. And I think it's going to be about content and developers. Like if developers can't easily get their content, get their apps onto these devices, and it's not an attractive ecosystem for them, I don't think they're going to succeed. But I think content's key because the carriers are looking for ways in which they can shovel content towards their users, right? The OEMs want to sell handsets, and the carriers want to get content out to people. Now, I know a lot less about Yola. I know that Firefox OS are focusing on the lower end market, and I don't think they have much of a content strategy beyond making it easy to get HTML5 apps onto the device. And what worries me a little bit about Firefox is that, and this is a good thing about them, is that they really hold the open web as a core philosophy in what they're doing.
I worry that
may get in the way of their commercial opportunities that are open to them because they hold that philosophy so strongly. Now, Ubuntu is very open, and I think that we have a very strong philosophy, but I think that we're a little less rigid in that. So,
but remember, Firefox's point is not to sell phones and therefore to bring the open web. It's to bring the open web to everybody, and phones are one way of doing that.
Exactly.
If phones turn out not to be a way of doing that, the answer is not to say, oh, that's standing in our way. The answer is to say, oh, well, phones weren't the way of doing that, because if shipping a phone requires locking stuff down, the Firefox people are going to go, well, that's not a good way of bringing the open web to people then, is it? Let's do something else.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough as well because those content relationships, frankly, are open to a very limited number of people, I suspect, right? I mean, like, you know, if Microsoft are going to have a deal with Netflix, for example, it's going to be a couple of executives sat in a room figuring this stuff out. And you've got to have a certain amount of money behind you, a certain amount of market share behind you. And that's where I think it's a big unknown game with any of these open source phones is, while they don't have the market share, are the content companies going to want to target it, you know?
No, which is the chicken and egg situation we've had forever. You know, with everything that we do, people won't talk to you. You haven't got a lot of users. You won't get a lot of users because people won't talk to you. QED.
And now on top of that, which we've already had in the Linux world, we've already struggled with that. Now you're adding the carriers in, which is a whole nother ugly, ugly mess put on top of something we've already had a problem with.
Well, bear in mind like I said right at the beginning, there are definitions and definitions of success. I mean, if you can buy, for instance, you can buy a phone today with Sailfish, with Yola on it. You can buy a phone today with Firefox OS on it. You can go to a carrier of your choice and get a SIM-only deal and then put that SIM in that phone. At that point, you have an open-source phone and a carrier relationship, and everything's fine. You've got to pay £500 for the phone rather than getting it subsidized for $29.99 and then a two-year contract. But you can do that today. And to some extent, that success. The worry is that if the company who makes it, Yola or Canonical or Mozilla, have to invest millions and millions and millions in order to get it to that stage, they don't recoup the investment.
Yeah, and, you know, even though, I mean, Jeremy raised a good point about Microsoft. This is probably me just completely drinking the Kool-Aid, but I think that just because Microsoft are not succeeding doesn't mean that I don't think that means that any of the open source phones won't succeed as well. Because I think Microsoft are quite different in this regard. Like what they're offering, I get the impression that the mobile industry is very open to the notion of an open platform, a more open platform, in the same way that Android revolutionized the mobile phone industry because it was more open. But all of these arguably are a lot more open than Android, so I think there is a good opportunity there for them. But the question is again, like, are we going to get there? I mean, I honestly don't know. I think every one of them is doing a good job in trying to get there, but I just don't know. I mean, who knows?
So I've used an Ubuntu phone very briefly, and I've used a Fire Phone OS Fox, or at least played with it. I didn't use that one. I've never even seen a Sailfish.
Fire Phone OS Fox?
Fire Phone OS Fox. Sailfish, I'm not exactly familiar with. Am I correct in that it's built on top of Mir, which was a fork of Migo, which was the result of Mamo and Moblin merging? And this is a project we're taking seriously?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, that's essentially it, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Have you guys used any of these? I mean, I've obviously used Ubuntu. I've used a Firefox phone. I've never used a Yola phone.
Every single one. Yeah. And they're all great. They're all fantastic in their own way. I mean, everyone has their own strengths and weaknesses, and all of them honestly provide a pretty classy user experience. I mean, Firefox OS and, you know, Ubuntu Touch both provide an interesting, classy, good-looking user experience. So I don't think any of them suck at all. I think all of them are awesome.
I would disagree. I never like talking smack about other projects. I don't think it gets anyone anywhere. I've used a Firefox OS phone, two different people's phones with the same device. It was the Geek's phone.
Yeah.
And it was really slow and really, really laggy. Now, I don't know whether that may have been that the hardware just wasn't up to spec for running the software.
Bear in mind, when they say they're going after low-end phones, if you take Firefox OS and put it on a Nexus 4, it'd run like billio. They started with an incredibly low spec phone, something where Ubuntu wouldn't even start up. You know?
I agree. I'm not
disagreeing with you. I think what the problem with the Firefox people is when they went with a hardware manufacturer, they went too low spec.
I guess from my perspective, and I appreciate that I'm massively biased here. The experience of using Firefox OS, it was just kind of there, you know. It wasn't very exciting to me. It wasn't a luxurious experience to me, which arguably is the market they're going after. They're going after the lower end devices, and you can't squeeze out really nice animations and transitions and things like that without requiring a higher powered handset. I was amazed that they shipped that device because it was dog shit slow. I mean, it was really dog shit slow.
Tell me how you really feel about Firefox OS there.
I mean, I love the project. I love the people who are working on it, but
Yeah. Hey, by the way, everyone in Mozilla, nice. I love what you do, but everything you make is dog shit.
But it's it's nice that they have secured a deal. They've secured deals with both handset manufacturers and carriers.
Oh, right. Totally, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Which is good stuff. I mean, the thing earlier about the levels of success, again, each of those platforms, Ubuntu, Firefox OS, Yola, are at a position where I could have one of their phones and be roughly okay with it. I have an Ubuntu phone, I've been working with it, and I've used the other two, and I could use them as my daily phone the whole time. Could my mum use them? Ubuntu's not ready yet, but it will be soon, I think. Firefox she could probably use today. The thing they're missing is she'll hear from one of her friends, oh, you should play this game, and they won't have it, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And it's what's interesting to me is with the three of them, and this is just based upon my experience, which is obviously limited to certain areas. I know a lot more about Firefox OS and Ubuntu, obviously Ubuntu, than I know about Yola. I don't know as much about Yola. And to me, I see Ubuntu and Firefox as completely different. I see Ubuntu going after the higher end, like competing with Apple and Google, and Firefox is kind of forging its own way into a new set of markets.
But didn't Shuttleworth say that the target market for Ubuntu Phone was developing markets such as India and China? I mean, that's a direct
quote. Well, I think it's developed. Yeah, I think what he means by that is we're not going to be able to release an Ubuntu phone in America anytime soon with one of the major carriers. It's just not there yet.
So your goal is to compete with iOS and Android, but then
is to release higher end phones in developing markets.
Yeah, the impression I have about the distinction there is that Firefox are looking at the smartphones you've already got in developing markets and saying that's what we're targeting. Ubuntu are saying we want to convince developing markets to buy higher end phones and then put Ubuntu on them.
Exactly, and I think that that's what the reason why I don't really compare the two of them. And I think they're both doing a good job in their own way. What concerns me more is I don't know anything about Yola, and I thought all kind of plugged into it.
Well, one of the 800,
which I mean, that's the last Mamo phone device that I've actually owned. The 900 actually was a cool device, kind of way ahead of its time.
Yeah, right. Awesome. I had the N9. It won design awards and everything. You know, I like that stream. And Yola runs Android applications, which solves the my friend said I should run this app and it's not there.
How well does it run your Android applications? That's a hard problem to solve.
Oh, it certainly is. It runs it better than any of the alternatives.
It's working out very well for BlackBerry.
Yeah. Burn. All right.
This is a massive topic, and there's no way we can cover all of it.
So it sounds like our general team view is it's a ballsy move to be successful. You know, in terms of market success in any of this.
It's definitely high risk, high reward.
Yeah, but it sounds like Mozilla and Ubuntu are doing a pretty decent shot at what they're doing. We know a little bit less about Yola, but it's good to have that kind of competition out there.
You'll achieve enough success. You'll achieve enough success for me. I'm sure each of those platforms. Will you achieve enough success for my mum? Different question.
So on the show now, we've got Jeff Atwood, who is the mastermind behind Discourse, which is a new evolution of how people communicate on the internet. It's essentially a nicer replacement for the crusty old forum. Now, I've probably massively misrepresented Discourse here. So, Jeff, why don't you give us an idea of what problem you're trying to solve here?
I think it was a fair representation. My previous project was Stack Overflow and Stack Exchange, which are Q&A engines, and it's related to discussion forums. Part of the problem we were trying to solve was a lot of the information on forums was old and out of date, hard to get to, hard to process mentally. And our solution was to build the Q&A engine that became Stack Overflow and Stack Exchange. But at the end of that project, I realized that we had done a bang up job on Q&A, and as anyone who's doing Google searches will attest.
Right.
But we hadn't really solved at all the problem of social discussion. Stack Overflow is a very directed. It's a place of directed learning. Really, it's not really where you go to hang out and have random discussions.
Yeah.
And people who want that get really frustrated with Stack Overflow and Stack Exchange because they kind of want a place to hang out and talk to their programmers about just anything. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's not what that engine is designed to do. And we found a lot of times if you're trying to just get the answer to a problem, discussion kind of gets in the way because it takes you in so many different directions and it adds a lot of content to the topic that may or may not be the answer. So you actually suppress discussion a lot of times. And although that works brilliantly for Q&A, it's kind of disappointing if you're trying to have a social club of some kind. So when I got out of the Stack Overflow and Stack Exchange project, I would have startups come to me and ask me for advice and say, "Hey, Jeff, what do you think of our startup?" And that was tough for me because the first thing I would say to them is, "Well, maybe I'm not really in the audience for your startup. Like, I don't know if I'm the right person to ask about what you're doing."
Right.
But if you do want advice, it seems to me the people you should be asking are the people that are your community, that are already using your software and are engaged with it and like it and already know about it. Why aren't you asking them what they think about what you're doing? And they would reply, "Okay, brilliant idea, Jeff. Now, how do we do that? Like, how do we get a community?" And at that point, I had to kind of play sad trombone because all the existing community software, forum software, that isn't like support software. There's some okay support options like Git Satisfaction and stuff like that. But I'm not really talking about support. I'm talking about a place where people who love your thing go to talk about, you know, just hang out with each other and talk about how much they love your thing and talk about, you know, each other. And it's really kind of a social club with the topic being this thing that you do or you create that they love. And if you look at, for example, a project like Kickstarter is all about building these massive communities of people that just love this thing that you're going to do that you haven't even necessarily done yet, right? I'm going to do this thing. It's going to be awesome. And there's all these people going, "Yes, that would be totally awesome. Here's $25. I would love that."
Right.
And they then want to talk about it, you know, because it doesn't exist.
So,
and they love the idea.
So where do we stand today with Discourse? I mean, I remember when you guys were first started talking about it and, you know, we've deployed it to power the Bad Voltage community.
We have.
And it's working great for us. But how far along towards your ultimate vision are you?
Well, we launched in February. And we said, look, we're version 0.8. It was 0.8. Because, you know, it's good enough to use, but it's not done. It's not version 1.0.
Right.
And we knew the road was going to be a little rough because, you know, no battle plan really survives the enemy. You know, all the assumptions we made about the way things work and what's going on will need refinement. And that's what we've been doing over the last, 8 months is really letting people install it, picking a couple partners that are official partners. Boing Boing is our big one. How To Geek is another one. And then Ubuntu is ramping up now. Ubuntu is our third partner.
Right.
I haven't talked about them much yet because they're still getting the feeds going, all the content. That's our third partner. So we look really closely at these partners and see, you know, what's actually happening. How are people actually using the software? And I'd like to do what I call complaint-driven development. I try to see how many people are complaining about given things that your software does. And the things that they're complaining about, they're usually where there's smoke, there's fire, there's some problem there. And this can range from people want your software to do something radically different than what it does to just things in your software that are really problematic and not easy to understand. And that's why people keep complaining about it. But
That's an interesting point there. Speaking as the guy who runs community.badvoltage.org, which is our Discourse forum, if I were to have a complaint, it would be almost opposite to everybody else's, which is that it's still moving really, really fast. And what happens is our forum sends me increasingly irritable emails saying, "You need to upgrade it immediately. I know you only did it yesterday. Do it again," which is fine. I mean, I understand that the project's moving quickly, but Do you anticipate that it will move this quickly for a long time and therefore you shouldn't really get on the discourse bandwagon unless you're prepared to deal with that? Or is the idea that that will slow down relatively quickly and you'll hit a kind of a stable state of play?
Well, I think it's going to move fairly quickly regardless, just because that's how things stay alive and that's how things grow.
I was worried you were going to say that.
if you look at projects that are dead, it's because they're not really changing, you know, and software kind of has to evolve. I can't really think of any software that stayed the same for, say, a couple years. It wasn't essentially dying. Now, there's rates of change, and, you know, this thing just started, so we told people... when we started, it's like, look, there's going to be some pain if you adopt early because it's still very beta. And we mean beta, not like this fake beta that everybody is now. Beta forever. This is really, really beta.
I was going to say, on the flip side of that, are some of the traditional forum players are releasing at a disconcertingly slow pace, going shocking amounts of times between releases. So
it depends on your taste as well. I mean, you're buying into something that's kind of experimental here. And it's going to go fairly fast. Now, that said, we are moving towards 1.0 and around February of next year. And we will have a formal 1.0 release where we say, look, this is a release that is going to have some longevity. We'll patch it to 1.0, 1.1. Nice. But it'll slow down a little bit, right? Like once we get to 1.0, we're going to support 1.0 for a while. We're going to freeze for like a month or so and just bake in 1.0. So there will be a release. It's like, look, we're confident that discourse basically works. We've used it in enough different situations with enough, you know, partners and customers that there's no major holes in the way that discourse works. Yeah. And that'll be version 1.0. We're really getting there. I mean, are the list of things that, you know, we really should have but don't is pretty short now for discourse. There's always an infinite number of potential improvements, but you could point to 20 things at launch in February of this year. We see discourse really is missing these things. And I would agree with you. It's like it doesn't have those things. But we sort of build as we go. That's the philosophy. Again, complaint-driven development. What are people complaining about the most? Because we want to build that part first. I don't want to go build something that scratches some itch that I have that nobody else really cares about, right? Like, you want to build things that people want. And the way people tell you that what they want is, first of all, they care enough to complain, right? I mean, if you don't care, then you're not going to complain. But who cares? Deal with it. I have something else to do with my life. I don't have time to tell people all the stuff that they're missing. But if they care enough to complain, that's a good sign. And if they're complaining about similar things, that gets bumped up in the list for us. And the volume of complaints is going down.
Why are people jumping onto discourse? What is it exactly that makes it more appealing to than, say, PHP BB or vanilla or one of the various other forums out there? If someone already has a forum package installed, what's the compelling reason for them to jump on discourse at this point?
Well, one reason is that it's fully 100% open source. This is fairly rare in the forum world. What they tend to do is have the pay version that's good, and then the crippled version is open source, if they do it at all. And PHPB, I believe, is open source, but it is really terrible. And by terrible...
Yes.
Let me clarify by what I mean by terrible. What I mean is it was designed, clearly designed, in basically like 1999, and they have not gone back to revisit any of those assumptions they made in the 1999 design.
So what you're saying is it's terrible because it sucks, right?
It's like driving a car that was built in the 1930s. It drives, but it has none of the amenities that you would really want in a car you bought today. You know, I mean, a lot of it's really tiny stuff. Like it could literally be, where's the cup holders? You know?
Yeah. Discourse. PHPBB with electric windows. But yes, absolutely. But absolutely. I mean, the experience of using discourse is, from a user's perspective, is infinitely, infinitely more pleasant than everything else around.
Unfortunately, Jeff, we're gonna have to draw this to a close, but I have one very, very important question. And I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but I think we're gonna get a lot of interest from our community about this. and they're going to have their own questions. So what we'd like to ask people to do is, if they can go, after they've listened to this, if they can post questions for you on our Discord site, and would you mind going and following up and answering their questions at a later date?
Sure, I can definitely do that.
Wonderful.
Because luckily, you use this excellent forum software that makes it very easy for me to participate.
Speaking of which, that whole highlighting text and being able to quote it, that is pure genius. Nothing else in humankind matters compared to that feature. So thank you for that. But thank you, Jeff, for joining us on the show. Really appreciate the work that you're doing. Keep up the great work. We love Discourse. We're all big fans. And we'll speak to you soon.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. And I'll pop over to that topic and answer what I can.
Thank you. Excellent. Thanks so much.
Bye, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
We've received about 50 zillion emails over the last 2 weeks. Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. I wanted to read one out from a chap called Michael, who first of all gives me a kicking for speaking too fast in my Ender's Game review. As he's a non-native English speaker, I'd like to say, you know, I'm sorry about that. On the other hand, I'm probably not going to change it. So
so thanks for your email.
Thank you for your feedback. But more importantly, he has a question about the drone stuff. We had Chris Anderson on talking about drones delivering things and so on. And he says, what do we think about drone hijacking? The beauty of this being that presumably if Amazon start delivering stuff via drones and you work out how to hijack drones, then it's Christmas every day for you, which would be rather nice. So
a bunch of pikeys in Liverpool stealing drones and selling them on eBay. Is that what he's talking about?
Bunch of pikeys.
Right. But seriously, I mean, do we think the drone hijacking stuff, is it likely to be a big problem? This is Michael from Munich genuinely asking the question. Thoughts in one sentence?
They've got to fix that. I mean, they can't possibly launch Amazon Prime Air if people are going to go around stealing drones.
I mean, UPS and FedEx leave packages on random porches throughout the world all the time, and it's going to be a big issue.
This is the thing, right? Half the time when I get stuff delivered, it goes to my next door neighbor or someone a mile down the street by mistake, right? Why is a drone any different? But in fact, it might crash into my house and blow up or something, obviously, but ignoring that.
I think, a way bigger concern is people with paintball guns taking those drones out. I mean, people are already trying to shoot down the big government drones in a couple of states around America. I don't think people are going to stop at that.
Yeah, I agree. So,
especially if it's carrying like a big teddy bear or something, that is way too tempting a target.
Just imagine the Reddit pictures and videos that when they launch the drones thing, some people are going to screw with them. It's going to be brilliant.
Dude, right?
Right, but yes, thank you, Michael from Munich. Brian,
all right, next? I got an email here from Ken Fallon over at Hacker Public Radio, and he sends me a whole lot of text. I'm going to skip all of it and just read a very small snippet. I'm going to do my best to try and not take it out of context, kind of. He says, and I quote, "With all this talk of building the community, the elephant in the room most surely be the past history of all the hosts involved in Bad Voltage, with each being in podcasts that either stopped abruptly, pod-faded, or switched from audio to video formats. How do you go about regaining and building the trust with the community?"
Pod fading?
I don't know exactly what pod fading is, but I think he has a point. I mean, geez, Lug Radio only ran for how long, Jono, there?
Four years.
Let's see. I did the Linux Action Show for about 6.5 years.
LQ Radio ran for about 5.
About 5 years. So you're right. You know what? We barely got started, and we just stopped out of nowhere. You're absolutely right.
As far as I can tell, what pod fading means is you failed to provide this show until the day you died, and that's unacceptable.
Bastards.
Total bastards. But I appreciate your feedback there, Ken, but you are totally wrong. All right, Jeremy, you got anything cool for us?
All right, on to feedback from James Hanna, and it was also a pretty long email. I'm going to pick what I feel are the two most salient points, and it's, I'm wondering if you guys are thinking about financials at all with regard to Bad Voltage. Does this show need to support itself to stay alive, or is the production cost cheap enough that it is covered? And the most important part of the email was also, Jeremy showed up despite being sick, whereas Brian didn't, just saying. First of all, James, I would like to say, that's a very good observation, and I don't know what Brian's problem is. You'll have to take that up with him. As I said when I was sick in the show must go on regardless of how I personally am feeling.
Yeah. Lazy bastard.
Absolutely.
As for the first part, the show really does not cost us anything. I mean, the plane ticket to fly to meet the studio, the rental studio costs, the professional audio editor.
Yeah.
We're all independently wealthy, so we don't worry about those things.
Exactly. It actually costs us a lot of money to make the show. And if we're unable to fund it, we've been doing it out of our own wallet so far. If we're unable to fund it, then we may have to stop doing Bad Voltage. So
it would be a pod fade.
How could we don't want a pod fade because we know how that goes down.
So, yeah. So send us some donations.
Send us some Bitcoin.
We'll also accept Litecoin.
It's a circle of life.
Yeah, send us like some whatever coin. Yeah, we have thought about financials and we've thought, yeah, we don't want any part of that. Not interested.
You know,
yeah,
we can
do the show
we
because this
our
is
own
topics and things that we're passionate about. We really enjoy doing it. And the costs of the show really are very, very minimal.
Yeah. I mean, we're doing this for fun. We're not expecting to make any money out of it. We just want to do something that's fun for us and the community can have fun with. And that's it. And it's very, very low cost for us.
If you want to send us money or stuff to review or whatever, then, you know, don't let us stand
in
your
way. That said, if you are a talent agent and would like to pick this up for syndication, email syndication@badvoltage.org and we'll be sure to get right back to you.
I'm pretty sure that one thing that we're never going to see in our inbox is the words talent agent. Anyway, so all of this mirth and fun now needs to center on a rather serious email that we've received from Landon Jones, who was an extra in Star Wars. it starts out with Guys and Brian, because you are obviously not one of the guys, Brian.
Interesting.
But I want to go through this in a little bit of detail because Landon gives us quite a kick in the spuds. I'm through to over 2.5 episodes. So far, you've occasionally irritated the piss out of me, but I can't stop listening. You sound like my wife. My feedback is the following. First of all, listen to what your guests are saying. In your first interview, you ask how long Stephen's been a tech journalist, which he answered in his introduction. Okay, what do you guys think? Whatever. Don't ask your guest questions that are better answered going to the website, because you know, why listen to a podcast when you can read everything on the internet? Really? I mean, he says,
this has
why
been
the hell
a very
would you ask
ornery
Stormy?
Letter section. You guys are upset.
Yeah, seriously. That's holidays time. You should be happy. He says, why in the hell would you ask Stormy where you can get devices? Also, you seemed ornery during this interview.
Went from ornery interview to ornery letters.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we were... First of all, I didn't know what the word ornery meant until quite recently, but I don't think we were like that with Stormy in the interview. I thought that was pretty good in the interview. But yeah, the reason why we asked Stormy a question about where we can get devices is because it's a fucking podcast. That's what we're here to do. We're here to ask questions, okay? The point is,
well, that does seem like a question that the general listener would be interested in. I don't think that's a bad question.
What are you guys talking about? If a company makes a phone, nobody wants to know if they can buy the phone or not, or where. Those are not important topics.
This is not an important question. Next point, learn about a product before reviewing it. Your reviews so far have been very weak. Well, thank you, Landon. There was misinformation about the Chromecast, as YouTube is streamed to the device directly. It sounds like I'm being nitpicky. Yes, it does. And I am. Okay, then. And only because I would like to give you guys a source of information and just for entertainment. I can't trust you guys to inform me on a new topic if you can't get on. I can't trust you guys to inform me on new topic if you can't get on. I know about correct.
I agree completely with what he just said right there, by the way.
I think you just missed a vowel at the end of on there.
Did the Brian Sucks address work? I CC'd the show so I could make sure it went through. And what is your business model? So, Landon, in a nutshell, we genuinely appreciate your feedback. We're trying to do the best that we can, but you know what? We're a podcast. The whole point is that we ask questions to the people that we're talking to. And you make a good point about us trying to do a better job with reviews, but you know what? We're doing the best that we can.
And I'll say it's very on. This is obviously show 5. I think each and every review hopefully will get better. And we're obviously striving to improve as much as we possibly can here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, Landon, in all seriousness, we appreciate your feedback.
The other guys are really trying hard to improve for you.
He's not even trying hard to show up, so improving is not even on his radar.
Hey, who's here today, mother? I am sitting right here, yo.
Now, we've read out some emails right here, you know, and traditionally this segment's all about reading out emails. We're now going to transition this a little bit. Now we have the community forum at community.badvoltage.org. So send your messages there, and we're going to be picking out the best ones from there. You can still email us at show@badvoltage.org, but we're really going to focus this segment on the best that we've seen on the Bad Voltage forum. So go to community.badvoltage.org, and it might get read out in the show.
And that wraps up what is Season 1, Episode 5 of Bad Voltage, although I will point out that this is really Episode 3 for some of us.
Yeah, absolutely.
For the important cast members.
Are you feeling better,
Brian?
I am feeling better.
Yeah, well, man. I heard it was so terrible for you, and in fact, seeing all your holiday photos on Google+, it underlined that point, really, in honesty. just how ill you were, you idle shit.
It's the truth. Oh man! Actually,
so how was your trip to Europe? By the way,
it was actually very, very cool. I got to go check out your guys' old stomping grounds around the UK there, and it was fairly awesome. In fact. I got sick as a dog for about a week of it, but you know, that didn't stop me from getting down to check out all the really, really old stuff that you can touch that's all over England. And that was pretty cool.
I seem to remember as well that you shared, this was an important thing to share on the internet, I think, that you defecated in the Tower of London.
Dude, correct? I absolutely did. And if you think about this here for just a second, think about all of the amazing historical figures that have also taken a giant dump in the Tower of London. People that have since died, and they've made movies after. That was awesome. That was one of the highlights of my whole year.
So you're trying to suggest that you are to be spoken in similar circles of kings and queens of England because you took a dump in the Tower of London. Is that what you're
absolutely
basically trying to get at?
I Anne am of Cleves, poo Brian buddies Lunduk with Anne of Cleves. Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. We're the same. We're the same when it comes to where we take a dump.
The worst thing here was when all the ravens died.
It's a dirty bomb.
And the kingdom falls.
Anyway, on that ringing
bomb,
note,
on that bombshell.
On that bombshell. This is our last episode of 2013. So you know, I think it's been a great start to Bad Voltage. We want to say a big thank you to everybody who's started listening to the show and who sent the feedback in. Of course, you can contact us at show@badvoltage.org as usual, but we really want to encourage you to go to our fantastic community forums at community.badvoltage.org. Feel free to talk about ideas for the show, suggest interviews, but also just talk about stuff that you're doing, stuff you're interested in, topics that you want to talk to other members of the community about. So I guess we'll wrap it up, fellas.